From religion, the next step had been when Storm had announced, "I need a partner to practice a new dance with." Mark had wound the gramophone, changed the needles, and danced to Storm's instruction. "You really are quite good, you know," she had told him magnanimously, smiling up at him, light and graceful in his arms as they spun around the empty ballroom of Emoyeni. "You'd make a crippled blacksmith look good." "Oh, la," she laughed. "You are the gallant, Mr. Anders." This had all changed abruptly. Since they had arrived in Cape Town, she had neither smiled nor spoken directly to him, and Irene Luchars, who was to have been a house guest of Storm's for 4 months, stayed only one night, and then caught the next mail ship home. Her name had not been mentioned again, and Storm's hostility to Mark had been so intense that she could hardly bear to be in the same room with him. Now Mark felt like a thief in her studio, but he had not been able to resist the temptation to steal a glimpse of the progress she had made on her latest canvas. Full-length windows had been put into the north wall for the light, and they looked out onto the mountain. Storm's easel stood in the centre of the bare, uncarpeted floor, and the only other items of furniture were the artist's stool, a carpenter's table cluttered with paint pots, and a chair on the raised model's dais. Framed canvases in all sizes and shapes were stacked against the walls, most of them still blank. At one stage, during the period of friendliness, she had even asked Mark to help with the timber framework. He felt a pang when he remembered. She was a ruthless supervisor, checking every joint and tack with a perfectionist's meticulous care. The canvas was almost completed, and he wondered when she had found time to do so much work in the last few days, and realised that he had misjudged her. She had been working in the mornings when he had believed she was lying abed, but now he became absorbed by the picture. He stood before it with his hands thrust into his pockets and felt a glow of pleasure spread slowly through his body. It was a picture of trees, a forest glade with sunlight playing on earth and rock, and two figures, a woman in a white dress stooping to gather wild flowers, while a man sat aside, sprawled against a tree trunk, and watching her. Mark was aware that it was a great advance on anything she had painted before, for although it was a simple picture, it evoked in him an emotion so strong that he felt a choke in his throat. He was awed by the peculiar talent which could have produced this work. He marvelled at how she had taken reality and refined it, captured its essence, and made of it an important occasion. Mark thought how it was possible for an untrained eye to pick out special talent in any field, just as a person who had never watched épée used before would recognise a great swordsman after the first exchange. Now Mark, who knew nothing of painting, was moved by the discovery of real beauty. The latch clicked behind him, and he spun to face it. She was well into the studio before she saw him. She stopped abruptly, and her expression changed. Her whole body stiffened, and her breathing sounded stifled. "What are you doing here?" He had no answer for her, but the mood of the picture was still on him. "I think that you will be a great artist one day." She faltered, taken completely off balance by the compliment and its obvious sincerity, and her eyes slipped away to the picture. All the antagonism, all the haughtiness, drained from her. Suddenly she was just a very young girl in a baggy smock, smeared and daubed with oil paint, and with a wash of pleased and modest colour spreading over her cheeks. He had never seen her like this, so artless, so open and vulnerable. It was as though for a moment she had unveiled the secret compartments of her soul to allow him to see where she had kept her real treasures. "Thank you, Mark," she said softly, and she was no longer the glittering butterfly, the spoiled, flighty little rich girl, but a creature of substance and warmth. The rush of his own feelings must have been as obvious. He had almost succumbed to the desire he felt to take her in his arms and hold her hard, for she stepped back a pace, looking flustered and uncertain of herself, as though she had read his intention. "And yet you won't slide out of it that easily." The curtains were drawn hastily across the secret places, and the old familiar ring was in her voice. "This is my private place. Even my father wouldn't dare come in here without my permission first obtained." The change was extraordinary. It was like a superb actress slipping into a familiar role. She even stamped her foot, a gesture that he found suddenly insupportable. "It won't happen again," he assured her brusquely, and he stepped to the doorway, passing her closely. He was so angry he felt himself trembling. "Mark!" She stopped him imperiously, but it was with an effort he forced himself to turn back. His whole body felt rigid, and his lips were numb and stiff with anger. "My father asks permission to come in here," she told him, and then she smiled, a slightly tremulous but utterly enchanting thing. "Couldn't you just do the same?" She had him off balance, his anger not fully aroused before she assuaged it with that smile. He felt the rigidity melting out of his body. But she had turned to the bench and was clattering her pots busily, and she spoke without looking up. "Close the door as you leave," she instructed, a princess tossing an order to a serf. His anger, not yet fully assuaged, flared again brightly, and he strode to the door with his heels clashing on the bare boards, and he was about to slam it with all of his strength and hope that it smashed off its hinges, when she stopped him again. "Mark!" He stopped, but could not bring himself to answer. "I'll be coming down to Parliament with you this afternoon. We will leave directly after lunch. I want to hear General Smuts's speech. My father says it will be important." He thought that if he tried to answer her, his lips might tear. They felt as stiff and brittle as parchment. "Oh, dear," she murmured. "I had completely forgotten. When addressing Mark Anders, Esquire, one must always say, please." She crossed her hands demurely in front of her, hung her head in a caricature of contrition, and made those dark blue eyes huge and soulful. "Please, may I ride to Parliament with you today? I would be ever so grateful, I really would. And now you can slam the door." "You should be on the stage. You're wasted as a painter," he told her. But he closed the door with studied deliberation, and she waited to hear the latch click before she dropped into the model's chair and began to shake with laughter, hugging herself delightedly. Gradually the laughter dried up, but she was still smiling as she selected a blank canvas from the stock and placed it on the easel. Working with charcoal, she blocked in the shape of his head, and it was right at the first attempt. "The eyes," she whispered. "Ah, his eyes are the key." And she smiled again as they appeared miraculously out of the blank canvas, surprised that she had them fixed perfectly in her mind. She began to hum softly as she worked, completely absorbed. The Assembly Chamber of Parliament House was a high square hall tiered with the galleries for press and visitors. It was panelled in dark carved indigenous wood, and the canopy above the Speaker's chair was ornately worked in the same wood. Softly muted green carpeting set off the richer green leather of the members' benches, and every seat was filled, the galleries crowded. But the silence that gripped that concourse was of extraordinary intensity, a cathedral hush into which the high, piping voice of the Prime Minister carried clearly. He made a slight but graceful figure as he stood in his seat below the Speaker's dais. "The entire Witwatersrand complex is passing slowly into the hands of the Red Commandos," he used his hands expressively, and Marg leaned forward to obtain a better view. The movement brought his outer leg against Storm Courtney's, and he was aware of the warmth of her thigh against his during the rest of the speech. "Three members of the police have been killed in a brutal attack at Fordsburg, and two others have been critically injured in clashes with Strikers Commandos. These groups are armed with modern pattern military firearms, and they are marching freely through the streets in quasi-military formations, committing acts of outrage on innocent members of the public, on public officers going about their duties, on all who cross their paths. They have interfered with public services, transport, power and communication, and have attacked and occupied police stations." Sean Courtney, who had been slumped in his front bench seat, with one hand covering his eyes, lifted his head and said, "Shame!" in a sonorous voice. It was his third whisky voice, and Mark could not help but grin as he guessed that the club lunch had fortified him for the session. "Shame indeed!" Smuts agreed. "Now the strikers have gathered about them all the feckless and dissolute elements in the community. Their mood has become ugly and threatening. Legitimate strike action has given way to a reign of terror and criminal violence. Yet the most disturbing aspect of this terrible business is that the management of this labour dispute, or should I say, the stage managing of the strike, has passed into the hands of the most reckless and lawless men, and these men seek nothing less than the overthrow of civilized government and a rule of Bolshevik anarchy. Never! Boomed Shaun, and the cry was taken up across the assembly. This house, and the whole nation, is faced by the prospect of bloodshed and violence on a scale which none of us expected or believed possible. The silence was unbroken now, as Smuts went on carefully. If any blame attaches to this government, it is that we have been too patient and shown too much forbearance for the miners' grievances. We have allowed them too much latitude, too much expression of their demands. This was because we have always been aware of the temper of the nation and the rights of individuals and groups to free expression. Quite right, too, Shaun agreed. Hear, hear, answered Hoor Hoor across the floor. Now, however, we have been forced to reckon the cost of further forbearance, and we have found it unacceptable. He paused and bowed his head for a moment, and when he lifted it again, his expression was bleak and cold. Therefore, a state of martial law now exists through the Union of South Africa. The silence persisted for many seconds, and then a roar of comment and question and interjection filled the house. Even the galleries buzzed with confusion and speculation, and the press reporters jostled and fought each other out at the exit doors in the race to reach a telephone. Martial law was the weapon of last resort, and had only been used once before, during the 1916 rebellion, when De Wet had raised his commandos again and ridden against Botha and Smuts. Now there were cries of protest and anger from the opposition benches. Herzog shaking his fist and his pince-nez glinting, while the government speakers were also on their feet voicing their support. The speakers' vain cries of "Order! Order!" were almost drowned in the uproar. Shaun Courtney was signalling to Mark in the gallery, and he acknowledged and helped Storm to his feet, shielding her through the excited press of bodies as they left the gallery and went down the passage to the staircase. The general was waiting for them at the visitor's entrance. He was scowling and dark-faced with concern. A measure of his agitation was the perfunctory kiss he dropped on Storm's uplifted face before turning to Mark. "A pretty business, my boy," he seized his elbow. "Come on, let's go where we can talk." And he led them to the members' entrance and up the stairs under the portraits of stern-faced chief justices to his own office. Immediately the door was closed, he waved Storm away to one of the chairs and told Mark, "The regiment was called out at 10 o'clock this morning. I managed to get Scott on the telephone at his home, and he's got it in hand. He's a good man. They'll be fully mobilised by now, and there's a special train being made up. They'll entrain and leave for the Witwatersrand at 11 o'clock tonight, in full battle order." "And what about us?" Mark demanded. Suddenly he was a soldier again, and he dropped neatly into the role. His place was with the regiment. "We'll join there. We leave tonight. We're going up in convoy with the Prime Minister, and we'll travel all night. You will drive one of the cars." Shaun was at his desk now, beginning to pack his briefcase. "How long will it take us?"
"Well, it's 1,000 miles, sir," Mark pointed out.
"I know that, dammit," snapped Shaun. "How long?"
Shaun had never liked nor understood the internal combustion engine, and his dislike showed in his ignorance of their speed and capability, whereas he could finally judge a journey by wagon or horseback.
"Oh, we won't be there before tomorrow evening. It's a hell of a road."
"Bloody motor cars," Shaun growled. "The regiment will be there before us by rail."
"They've only 300 miles to go." Mark felt obliged to come to the defence of the car, and Shaun grunted.
"I want you to get on home now. Have my wife pack my campaign bag and get your duffel together. We'll leave immediately I get home." He turned to Storm.
"Go along with Mark now, missy. I'm going to be busy here for a while."
Mark strapped up his bag and reflected how his worldly possessions had multiplied since he had joined the Courtney household. There had been a time when he could carry everything he owned in his pockets. The thought was broken by a knock on the door.
"Come in," he called, expecting a servant.
Only Ruth Courtney never came down this end of the house on her weekly inspection, a determined crusade against dust and cockroaches.
"Please take it down to the car," he said in Zulu, adjusting his uniform cap in the mirror above the washbasin.
"All on my own?" Storm asked sweetly in the same language, and he turned, startled.
"You shouldn't be here."
"Why not? Am I in danger of violation and ravishment?" She had closed the door and leaned against it, her hands behind her back. but her eyes bold and teasing.